case, United States v. Foltz. Ms. Zimmerman, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant? And Ms. Payne, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Very well, then, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. Chief Judge Olson, if I may reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Granted.
Thank you. Members of the court, jurisdiction exists in this case. Technical Sergeant Foltz's conviction, his direct appeal was and is ongoing. It was not final. The Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals properly exercised jurisdiction. They complied with the letter and the spirit of the National Defense Authorization Act of fiscal year 2023 in handling this case. The plain language indicates that, especially in conjunction when you consider the statutory scheme as a whole, because Sergeant Foltz still had a valid pathway to the Court of Criminal Appeals, the CCA, at the time that the law changed and went into effect. He was still within the 1 year time that he had to petition the Judge Advocate General, the TJAG, under Article 69 of the UCMJ after his Article 65D review.
And what, I think, what issue, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it's like, this is a mess. So what issues could he have raised in that? You're saying he still had a one-year opportunity to petition for Article 69 review.
Yes.
What issues was he authorized to raise in that?
He has a legal issue, Your Honor, of the sufficiency of his conviction. He raised and did raise it at the CCA a First Amendment challenge to his conviction, that the speech involved in the specification of conviction implicated his First Amendment rights, and that is the issue that he could have and would have raised under Article 69 had Congress not changed the law and shut that door. So when they changed the law, they not only opened the Article 66 CCA door, but they closed the TJAG 69 door at the same time.
And why wouldn't Article 69 C2 limit, like, why does that provision, which limits it just to withdrawals and waivers, say those are the only things that can be, at this stage, when you petition for Article 69 review, why would that not say, unless it's one of those three issues, you have nothing to appeal?
That's under the current version, Your Honor. You're absolutely correct, and that is exactly why we're saying that Congress intended for the courts to litigate those issues, because after December 23rd of 2022, TJAG is no longer authorized to handle those issues. But the prior version of Article 69 allowed an appellant to raise a substantive issue that was error prejudicial to his rights. And that's what he was planning to do, but had not done it as of the time that Congress changed the law. But you're making the point, Your Honor, you're exactly right, that after, and that shows why the plain language indicates that jurisdiction existed, because prior to the amendment effective date, Sergeant Foltz had a right to go to the TJAG under Article 69 and raise that First Amendment issue, but under the government's argument that on December 24th of the same year, he lost that right and not only could not go to TJAG, but the government is arguing he couldn't go to the CCA either. So basically, he's left with nowhere to go, and that can't be right.
But the review under 65 was limited. What provision do I look to in the 2019 version of the manual in the code that specifies that reassures me that he could have raised that substantive argument in Article 69?
I'll confess, Your Honor, I'm not good with numbers, and so the numbers and letters of all the subsections are not my strong point, but it's Article 69. I want to say C. I have to look at the statute. It's Article 69. It said that the TJAG can review errors prejudicial to an appellant's rights, and that's what, you know, quite frankly, we were planning to file until we found out about the change in the law.
I think I've got it. So may set aside in findings of sentence and hold in part on the grounds of newly discovered evidence, fraud on the court, lack of jurisdiction over the accused of the offense, error prejudicial to the substantial rights of the accused.
That's it.
So it's that provision. And you think that applies to any error that happened at any stage of the court-martial that would have had a stand? Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. And he had what we thought was a pretty strong First Amendment claim. And under the government's reading of the amendment, he now can present that claim to no one, except perhaps maybe an Article 3 court on habeas, but that's a different question.
So typically on direct appeal, military justice system, you can raise factual sufficiency. That's stripped away here. Does that indicate to this court that because of the limited scope, that this is collateral rather than direct?
Glad you asked that. So the government's argument is that Article 69 is collateral, and our argument, it is not, and there are several reasons for that. Number one, not only the Supreme Court, but this Court and the Court of Claims have all held that Article 69 and Article 66 in conjunction with each other constitute a direct appeal. And the case citations, the cases I'm talking about is the Supreme Court case of Ortiz, where they describe the quote-unquote appellate process as an integrated system of military courts and review procedures. And then this Court in Brown very specifically says Congress created a bifurcated statutory scheme for appellate review of completed courts martial depending on the sentence, and that the potential jurisdiction of the CCA attaches at the inception of the court martial. And that's our point, Your Honor, that you before the change in the law, there were basically three kinds of direct appeals, and it depended on what sentence the accused received at trial or was approved by the convening authority in the old days. So you had the people who got either a punitive discharge or 2 years or more of confinement, they get automatic review. They go straight from the trial court to the appellate court, do not pass go, do not go to TJAG, go straight to the CCA. If you got a little bit less significant sentence where you got more than 6 months confinement but less than the 2 years and you didn't get a punitive discharge, Congress recognized, that's a pretty, you're still getting a federal conviction and you still have pretty significant sentence, your liberty's restrained. So you're going to get a little bit less review. You can still get to the CCA. You are entitled to a court to review your legal issues, however you have to ask for it. That's what the old direct appeals were, is for that intermediate phase. Or the appellant could ask for the CCA to review the case, and the CCA had to review those cases. And then you have the last category where people got what in the old days might have been considered minor punishment, less than 6 months or less of confinement. And in those cases, Congress thought it was sufficient to weed out and possibly conserve legal resources or judicial resources of the CCAs by letting the TJAG handle the vast majority of those. Go to TJAG first. You have your Article 69D review where you review only basic issues like was there jurisdiction, did the specification state an offense, and was the sentence legal. Nobody is ever advised that they have the right to submit matters to the TJAG before the Article 65D review, and that is just a cursory review. But after that review is done, if an appellant, like Sergeant Foltz, had a substantive issue like a First Amendment issue, he then had 1 year to petition the JAG under Article 69 for review of that substantive issue. And so that was a three-part statutory scheme that I believe this Court was referring to in Brown, the Supreme Court referred to in Ortiz, and then the Court of Claims referred to it in McLean, where they said Articles 59 through 76 constitute direct appellate review of court-martial convictions. Did that answer your question, Judge?
Counsel, I'm a little puzzled by, I think we're all puzzled by Article 57, which says the case is complete, the appeals are complete when the 65 review is done. And yet, there was still a possibility of doing the Article 69 review. And we have to make sense of that. And I'm just trying to understand, why would they say in Article 57 that the appeal is done when the 65 review is over? Even though Article 57 takes no account of 69 at all, what could be the thinking there?
Judge Maggs, the thinking is look at the title of Article 57, which is the effective date of sentences. So Congress had to set forth the parameters of when the service can execute a punitive discharge or, God forbid, a sentence of death. Right? And so most cases don't get death sentences, so we're really not going to talk about capital cases much today. But Article 57 provides when the appeal is quote-unquote final for purposes of executing the sentence. So a punitive discharge is not final, is not executable until secretarial action, for example. And so a case could have its 65D review, but it's not final under Article 76 until the discharge is executed. And so that's why, if Article 57 answered the question, as you phrased it, Judge Maggs, if Article 57 was the end-all and be-all for finality, we wouldn't need Article 76. And as we know, we can't assume that Congress has a superfluous article of UCMJ in the statutory scheme. So the answer to your question more directly, Your Honor, is that Article 57 establishes when something is final for purposes of effectuating the sentence, for executing the sentence, not the entire appellate process. And it can't be for the very reason you notice. Even under the old system, an appellant after 65 review had the right for 69 review and then 66 review and then 67 review because it's all part of the direct appeal. That's the answer here. And it just couldn't be. And again, as I mentioned, it's not really a direct appeal if you can't submit matters. How would a TJAG even know for the 65 appeal that review that Sergeant Foltz had a First Amendment issue? Because he was never advised he could submit matters. He never knew he could. And he was waiting for the 69 to kick. And he still had over 6 months left on that one-year time frame when the statute changed.
Counsel, on that point, why are we so sure that the old version of Article 69 stopped being effective to pending cases when NDA 2023 was enacted? I mean, your argument is essentially that the government's position can't be right because he can't appeal to the CCA, and while he could appeal to the Article 69 before, as soon as the statute was enacted, he loses that right. Well, on the second point, what's your reasoning for that second point? I think you covered it in your brief. I'm just trying to understand it better.
It's the plain language of the statute, Your Honor. The plain language says that these amendments to this chapter, the NDAA said that these amendments they don't say an effective date, but under Johnson, the effective date is the date of enactment, right? But they do exclude two categories of cases, and that's further evidence, in my view, that the 69 TJAG review and the 66 CCA review are both part of an appellant's direct review under the old system. They're part of the direct appeal because Congress, in the plain language of the NDAA, said, you know, you only get one bite at the appellate apple. And so for those people who've already submitted their appeal to TJAG or their appeal to the CCA, they don't get the benefit. They don't get a second bite at the appellate apple. So Sergeant Foltz is in that group of transition or gap cases where their 65D had been done, but they hadn't had their full year to take advantage of the first step in the appellate process under the old system. But to answer your question more directly, it's the plain language of the statute that says these amendments are to take place except for the people who've already had their direct appeal. And so if Sergeant Foltz had filed an Article 69 appeal to TJAG in February of 2023 instead of his notice of direct appeal to the CCA, I think the TJAG would have said, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do for you.
What if he had filed his 69 before the NDA 2023 had taken place and had been enacted, and the TJAG said no relief? Could he then still appeal under 65, under your theory? So, I mean, he didn't, because he had a whole year to do it, but he didn't. But suppose he had done it on day one. It went up, and TJAG looked at it and said, sorry, you just don't have a claim. Could he then appeal once the NDA 2023 had been enacted under your theory?
That is an excellent question. Quite honestly, I didn't think of that. But I would say, yes, he could, because a matter of fundamental fairness, if he had the right before the law changed to do that, you can't. The change in the law was not intended to restrict appellate rights. It was intended to expand appellate rights of service members convicted at general and special courts martial. So it would be inconsistent with the statutory scheme.
But under your theory, wouldn't it be final once the Article 69 review is over?
It's only final, Your Honor, after the 69 decision from the judge advocate general. If he denies relief, then I believe that it's not final until the accused elects to or fails to ask the CCA for review, for discretionary review. That's what they had under the old system, was discretionary review. It's not final till all those steps go. And then if the CCA took the case, then it wouldn't be final until he went to this court and applied for discretionary review through a petition for grant of review. And then if this court granted review but denied relief, then he could have asked the Supreme Court to take it. And that's what Article 57C says. It lays out that whole process. It's part of the appellate process is either it starts 65 for those minor cases where that's all the appellant wants. He wants his DD-214 right away. He doesn't want to appeal anything. He probably had a guilty plea and got a very minor sentence. 57 has to say, well, that's the end of the appellate review for those cases, and now you can execute the sentence. But it says 65D review in paragraph 1, or the whole appellate process as we know it through 66 and 67, et cetera. That's where we are now in this case. We are in the second, we're under paragraph 2, not under paragraph 1. Did that answer your question?
Yes,
Your Honor?
Thank you.
Thank you. So I said there are five reasons why I think the plain language indicates that the court had, the CCA had jurisdiction. First of all, Sergeant Foltz met all of the qualifying factors, right? He had a conviction for, a conviction as general court-martial, and he timely filed his notice of appeal. And he did not, number two, he did not meet any of the, either of the two disqualifiers. He had not submitted any matters to TJAG under Article 69 or the CCA under Article 66 as of December 2022. Third, I believe that those disqualifiers that Congress included in the NDAA indicate agreement with this Court, Supreme Court, and the Court of Claims that the Article 69 and Article 66 are both part of direct appeal because they excluded them. If you've already had your direct appeal, you don't get another one. Fourth, I believe that Congress, in including those two disqualifiers, did that. They didn't explicitly do it, but I think it's plain language. You can infer that they were accounting for finality, okay? So, again, like I just said, you only get one bite at the apple. So if you've done your appeal already, we're not going to reopen it. So there's no Landgraf problem, there's no retroactivity problem, there's no reopening of a final judgment. And then fifth, as we've been discussing already, that by eliminating the Judge Advocate General's authority under, oh, I see my light is blinking.
Please continue with your fifth point briefly.
Thank you. So by limiting the TJAG's authority to answer questions on substantive legal issues, it's clear that what Congress is doing in this statute is they are merely shifting the responsibility for litigating these legal issues from a lawyer in the TJAG's office or even TJAG himself or herself. They're shifting it from there to a CCA where it's more proper for a court to litigate a First Amendment issue than a lawyer in TJAG's office. And that's clear from the plain language of the statute. And that's all that the Congress was doing, was saying, we're not going to have this anymore, three different levels of appeal. If you got a conviction and you want to appeal a substantive issue, you get to go to the CCA as long as you do it in time. And Sergeant Foltz was on time. His 1 year to go to TJAG made his case not final, and therefore he is able to avail himself of this new statute, as all four CCAs have applied, by the way.
Let me see if there are any further questions from the bench. Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Zimmerman.
Thank you.
Ms. Payne.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Mary Ellen Payne, and along with Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States. As of the 22nd of December, I'm sorry, the 23rd of December, or I'm sorry, as of the 22nd of December 2002, there is a final judgment as to the legality of the proceedings in appellant's case, and there had been for almost 6 months. But according to the Air Force Court, the next day in the 23 NDAA, Congress nullified that statutory final judgment and reopened direct appellate review of appellant's case, giving the Air Force Court the ability to review it. The problem with AFCA's conclusion is that even if Congress constitutionally could nullify a final judgment and reopen direct review, Congress never explicitly stated that that's what they were intending to do in the 23 NDAA. And for these reasons, AFCA erred in finding that it had jurisdiction over appellant's case, and this court should vacate the judgment below. The first thing I would like to do is correct a misstatement of the government's position that I believe that appellant's counsel made. Our position is that the old pre-NDA, 23 NDAA version of Article 69 does still apply to appellant, so he has not lost those rights. That is sort of a collateral issue, but I want to get back to why this case was final. And all we have to do is to look at the statute. Plot, the Supreme Court case, says that finality is determined by statute. And we look at the plain language of the statute here. Article 57, and it says that after 65D review is completed, that is a final judgment as to the legality of the proceeding.
So the way I understand the appellant's argument is they say, well, that's fine, but that's not the provision we're operating under. We're operating under C1B because there was a pathway through 69 that we could get 66, and therefore our 66 review or our potential for 66 review is not yet extinguished. So we don't know who the other provision applies to, and we don't care because we're under C1B. We still had the potential to get before the CCA. So why are they wrong about that?
They're wrong because what they're talking about is they have a potential for a more limited collateral type of review. If we look at the Supreme Court's definition of collateral, it is something that is outside of direct review, and we know per statute that direct appellate review finished after 65D review. I do want to cite United States versus Loving, where this court talked about the final judgment as to the legality of the proceedings. And Loving described that, although at that point it was under Article 71, now it's under Article 57. But Loving said that is the completion of direct legal review. So we have this court saying that's the end of direct review. So anything that comes after it has to, by definition from the Supreme Court, be collateral in nature. So they had access to this collateral review, but it was different. There were a whole series of hurdles that appellant would have to go through to get to the CCA. Number one, he would have to file a petition with TJAG. Then TJAG would either have to send it to the CCA, or appellant would have to apply. And there were rather strict requirements. The CCA had to find, in order to even grant review, again, it's discretionary.
I don't know if appellant's saying it's likely. I think their argument is just as we still had a path. So until our path to Article 66 review is extinguished, the case isn't final.
I don't believe that is congruent with the way that courts and the Supreme Court have treated finality. There are always, in many cases that have become final, whether it's in the federal system, in this system, there are many, many ways for another court to relook at the case, be it through quorum nobis petitions, habeas petitions. But despite the possibility of those additional types of review, we still treat the judgment as final unless and until, as a part of that collateral review, the case is actually overturned.
So the proper way, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
So the proper way in the government's view of interpreting Article 57 is then we really have to figure out the collateral versus direct review question, because the only way we can exclude this path to Article 66 is if we disqualify it because we consider it a collateral review, and therefore that's not what Article 57 is talking about.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think that has been well established through the manual for courts martial throughout the years that Article 69 review has always been considered a review that comes after final review. Those have been the words that have been used going back to the 69 manual and then in RCM 1209. Since then, we've seen them describing this as a type of review after final review, which certainly indicates that it's collateral. But I will say, Your Honor, even if it was a type of collateral review, I mean, even if it was part of direct review, that doesn't eliminate the need to do a land graph analysis, because we are still talking about a massive expansion. I probably shouldn't say massive, a substantial expansion of appellant's rights, because beforehand, this long road he had to take to the CCA, he couldn't even get factual sufficiency review. But now under these new changes, if they apply to him, he would be entitled to factual sufficiency review. So we're talking about an expansion of his substantive rights, and the Supreme Court has said if we're talking about if we're talking about an expansion of his substantive rights, that is still entitled to the presumption against retroactivity. And so we need to look and do a full Landgraf analysis. And if we do one in this case, even if we consider his case to be pending, we still have to look at whether or not Congress made a clear statement to say that this new amendment is going to apply retroactively. And they simply did not make a clear statement in this case.
Counsel, to go back to your first point about whether the old version of Article 69 applied to appellant, as I understood appellant's argument, the argument was that Congress wouldn't have decided not to give appellant the benefit of the new statute and at the same time taken away the rights that appellant had under the old statute. So your position is that even after the NDA 2023 was adopted, he still could have petitioned under Article 69 and had, under the old version of Article 69, and had whatever rights that old Article 69 would have had, to include, after that review, asking for review at the CCA. Is that correct?
Yes. We believe, and we're basing this somewhat on an order that the court put out in another case called Alford, but it seems that if you do apply a Landgraf analysis to the amendments to Article 69 to try to figure out whether or not they apply to appellant in this case, the new amendments should not apply because we look at, number one, did Congress expressly talk about the temporal reach? No, they did not. So,
as I understood appellant counsel, they basically said this applies, and then they had a couple exceptions, but this doesn't fit within one of the exceptions.
Right. And so what Landgraf has said is that we need a clear statement, and using merely a negative inference is not an acceptable clear statement that Congress needed to have made to say whether or not the amendments apply. So sort of the same situation happened in Landgraf. There were several changes that were made, statutory amendments that were changed. Congress specifically said that these two amendments were only going to apply prospectively, and the petitioner in Landgraf tried to argue, oh, well, since these provisions only apply prospectively, and Congress specifically said that, then everything else must apply retroactively. And Congress rejected that. They said that is not the kind of — I'm sorry, the Supreme Court rejected that. They said that's not the kind of clear statement that we need. So the negative inference in this case was not sufficient to specifically say that the amendments were going to apply, the amendments to 66 or 69 were going to apply to appellants. So if we're asking whether or not he still has rights under the old 69, yes, under Landgraf, because it would, taking away his 69 rights or whittling them down to be much less than they were, again, that is a change in his substantive rights. The Supreme Court has said if there's a change in substantive rights, the presumption against retroactivity applies. And so we look, appellant probably did, as Ms. Zimmerman said, appellant may have relied on having an entire year to submit his application to TJAG, and that's why, at the six-month period, he hadn't submitted it yet. And so it would be a retroactive effect to apply the new 69 to him and say, well, TJAG is just very, very limited in any kind of relief that he would be able to provide. So because there's a retroactive effect, it would be appropriate to apply the old Article 69 to him. So he has not lost those rights.
Do we know if anybody in any service applied for review under the old Article 69 after December 22nd, 2023?
I believe that in the Alford case that the court recently issued an order on, that he did, in fact, apply. Well, his EOJ came before, like appellant, his EOJ came before the 23 NDAA, and then he applied for 69 review after the effect. He applied for 69 review after the fact. And the court in that case seemed to apply the 2019 version, or the old version of Article 69, and so we're proposing that that would be the appropriate thing to do for appellant as well, if he were to apply. So, as far as finality goes and the difference between Article 57 and Article 67. In this case, finality under either of those provisions ends up being the same thing.
Well, counsel, you said 57 and 67. Did you mean 57 and 76?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Sorry. Too many articles I'm getting.
So going back then to Article 57, the appellant argues that let's say this isn't possible. The Congress would not have enacted two finality provisions, and that you must read Article 57, through the lens of the subsection it falls under, and say that and the language says, in this section, and this section being sentencing. And so all Article 57 is discussing is finality vis-a-vis sentencing, not the finality of the proceedings. What's the government's position with regards to that?
So, Your Honor, it is true that what appellant is saying about that is correct, but I think we have to look at everything in context, because not only does it talk about needing there to be finality of appellate review in order to execute sentences, but there is that 57C2 provision that says a final judgment as the legality of the proceedings. And that language has to mean something. And what Loving has said that it means is that it's the completion of direct legal review. So, again, it needs to mean something else. And I'll point out, for certain sentences, you absolutely need the end of appellate review in order to be able to execute the sentence. But for a case like appellant's, his sentence had been executed long before he even got Article 65 review. So again, that language in 57C2 must mean something, and it's a marker for Congress to say this is when the judgment is actually final. And if you look at Article 76 and how that's been interpreted in Loving, for example, the difference in between the final judgment is the legality of proceedings and then finality under 76 really just involves those cases where there's an extra step where the sentence has to be executed by a certain official, be it the president or the secretary, et cetera. That's not present in this case. And so you look at whether every review that is required under the code has been completed, and it has, because Article 69 is not a review that is required under the code. It is absolutely optional for an appellant to apply. It may not happen in many cases at all. So it's not an appropriate marker of finality. If Congress had wanted it to be a marker of 69 review or failing to apply for 69 review or failing to go to the CC afterwards, if they had wanted that to be the marker of finality, they could have certainly written in that into the rule the same way that they did with, after normal 66 review, then going to this court or going to the Supreme Court. That was written into a different part of the law. But notably, Congress did not do that. So if we look at the plain language of Article 76, appellate review as defined in the code in Article 57 has been completed in appellant's case. There was no other required review. And, if we look at the history of how the manual has developed, the manual, granted now it's in the discussion, but the manual, back in 69, it was actually part of the manual. The manual has consistently said that review under Article 69 by TJAG is not part of appellate review within the meaning of Article 76. So in this case, appellant's case was complete at the end of Article 65 review for purposes both of Article 57 and for Article 76. So I think something else that's important to point out is just the concept of jurisdiction in general, because what this court noted in Loving was that jurisdiction, of course, is neither granted nor assumed by inference. And to come to the conclusion that the Air Force Court had jurisdiction here, the court had to make a lot of inferences. They had to make that negative inference about the application of the sections that was disapproved of by the Supreme Court in Landgraf. And they had to assume, we don't think that Congress would have wanted to cut off his 69 rights, and so therefore we think that Congress wanted to give him these full Article 66 rights. I mean, that's an inference. That is not looking at the plain language of the statute. There's simply, under Landgraf, was no clear statement that the amendments were supposed to apply to cases like appellants, cases that already had a final judgment as to the legality of the proceedings. And that's problematic because, again, the court cannot just assume its jurisdiction through inference. And that was done, that was what was done, in this case. And I mean, I think an important thing to consider is Congress, and when we look at retroactivity and clear statements, we have to look at the fact that the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on retroactivity has said, if there are multiple interpretations of what the court could be saying about the application of the rule, then that's not a clear statement and that's not sufficient. And certainly one could look at the rule and say, well, maybe Congress didn't say that this case applied to cases that already had, or that the amendments apply to cases that already have final judgments, because it should be obvious that it shouldn't apply to those cases. And that is certainly a rational interpretation of what Congress could have been doing. And if a statutory amendment is susceptible to multiple interpretations, what the Supreme Court tells us is that is not sufficient to be able to apply the statute retroactively. Also, we have to look at the Plott case from the Supreme Court that suggests that a reopening of final judgments for direct appellate review poses constitutional issues, because Congress, they say the reopening of judgments by Congress is an exercise of judicial power, and there is nothing in the Constitution that gives Congress the ability to do that. And so, quite clearly, the Supreme Court says that's not the case, that should not be allowed. And so that, if we interpret that direct appellate review has been reopened here, there certainly is potentially a constitutional issue. Now
in that regard, I noticed in your brief that on page 42, you came out with a very bright line along those lines. You said, quote, "For Congress to annul a final judgment of a court would be an assumption of judicial power which is forbidden." Then two pages later, on page 44, you kind of equivocate. You say, "Interpreting the fiscal year 23 NDAA to reopen final judgments of courts martial, especially where nothing in the plain language of the NDAA purports to do so, raises serious constitutional concerns." Where do you fit as you stand here today? Is it a flat-out, bright-line, unconstitutional step of Congress, and therefore this Court would be completely in the wrong if we were to blow past that? Or are you more in the page 44 of your brief sphere where you're saying, well, there are constitutional concerns and they're particularly of concern in those instances where it was not explicitly stated by Congress?
Your Honor, I see my time is almost up. May I?
Please do.
Answer. So our position in this case is that, yes, this is a final judgment in the case, and it would be an unconstitutional assumption of judicial power for Congress to have overturned that. But the reason for the equivocating language is we acknowledge there are some differences between this case and Plott. Plott was talking about reopening judgments of Article III courts. This obviously would be reopening a judgment of an Article I entity. So Plott is not completely on point. We still believe that the principles of Plott do apply and it would be unconstitutional. But if this court has concerns, maybe Plott doesn't apply, I think we still get into the constitutional avoidance principle, because I still think, even if it's not absolutely 100% clear cut under Plott, certainly the issue has been raised. And when one interpretation of a statute raises grave constitutional concerns, as we believe it does in this case, it is this court's duty to apply the interpretation of the statute that does not raise constitutional concerns. And in this case, that would be taking the interpretation that these amendments do not reopen final judgments like appellants, and that there was no jurisdiction of the CCA under this case.
Further questions?
May I ask just one quick question?
Oh, please do.
What, if we were to agree with your position, what should our decretal paragraph say?
The decretal paragraph should vacate the, well, hold that there's no jurisdiction over the CCA had no jurisdiction over this case, and then vacate the CCA's decision.
And that's all we'd say.
Well, I mean, this court would say that you.
Well, not our holding, just in terms of sending the case back. That we're just done.
Vacate the decision, and I mean, I think that's the end. I mean, you can't remand it back to the CCA to take any action because they don't have any authority to take any action.
Any further questions? Seeing none, you may briefly conclude.
Because Congress did not clearly direct that the 23 NDA applies to cases with final judgments like appellants, the Air Force Court had no jurisdiction to review his case. We therefore ask this court to vacate the CCA's decision.
Thank you, Ms. Payne. Ms. Zimmerman?
Thank you, Chief Judge.
I'm going to skip around a little bit. I find myself in the very interesting position of arguing that all of the CCAs are correct. Usually when I'm standing here, I'm arguing that they were incorrect, but they were all correct when they found jurisdiction. The entirety of the government's argument is that this case was final, and it wasn't. And if this court agrees with us that it wasn't, then all of the government's arguments fall by the wayside. The direct appeal was in progress, and I want to talk about Landgraf.
Before you move on, there's one, right? They would argue that even if it wasn't final, that the NDAA still wasn't retroactive, right? That appellant would still live in the old scheme regardless of the enactment of the new law, right? That they, even if they're wrong about everything else, they still have that one argument, right?
I didn't see anything in the plain language of the statute that indicates that was Congress's intent at all. Congress made it very clear that we're changing the law, we're shifting the review of substantive issues from TJAG to the CCA, and if you've already had your appellate bite at the apple, you don't get to play. But everyone else, I mean, in the changes to Article 69, there's no transitional kind of language saying when the amendment would or wouldn't apply to certain classes of cases. So by the fact that it's not, there's no exclusions there. And so that gets us to, first of all, on Landgraf, it only applies when there's a final judgment, which our position obviously is, it's not a final judgment. You need finality first. But secondly, look at what Landgraf was about. Landgraf was a civil case between private litigants, as is, and I don't have enough time to talk about all the cases I read in the last few weeks, but all Kaiser and Hughes and Plott and every single case that the government cites on this, it's all private litigation. And the purpose of Landgraf is based on principles of unfairness, and that people should conform their conduct to whatever law is in effect at the time they take the action they take. And it's not fair if a plaintiff, for example, has a cause of action and then Congress changes the law to take that cause of action away. Well, that plaintiff had a vested right in that cause of action, and it would be unfair to take it away. Conversely, like in Landgraf, where the law changed in a way that made a defendant who gauged his actions based on the law at the time, but now under the new law, he's subject to not only back pay, just back pay, but also compensatory and punitive damages. And the court said, you can't do that, because when he sexually harassed Ms. Landgraf, he didn't know that he was going to be, you know, his employer would be subject to punitive damages. We can't go back and by the way, she'd already had her bench trial, which is all the, anyway, there's a lot of factual distinctions. I don't have time to go into them all, but the government having to defend against factual sufficiency arguments at the CCA is not the kind of concern that Supreme Court had in mind in a single case that I could find. The government did not have a vested right in only having to defend 69 appeals or legal sufficiency. I mean, that's their job. And Congress is the one who decides the jurisdiction of the CCA. And if they make a decision that that's the fair and just thing to do is to let the courts decide these issues from now on, then we ought to implement that. And I don't think there's any language in any of the statute or any of the NDAA to indicate otherwise. Also, I would note, let me just discuss Alford for a second. There's not a whole lot of information available to us on Alford, but I would respectfully disagree with counsel for the government's characterization of it. I'm looking at the summary disposition from this court, and I don't see anything about the court ordering that the old version of Article 69 is what applies. The court's summary disposition, as I read it, says, the words failure to file an appeal did not appear in either the old Article 69 or the new one. That appears to be the basis of the court's decision, but I don't have access to all the pleadings in that case. But the pleadings I do have access to indicate that his 65D review was done in March of 2023, which is after the effective date of the statute. So
I see your time has expired.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Any further questions? You may briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. As I mentioned, the government's argument relies on the case being final, and it's not. What Congress did was it made a direct route to the CCA instead of an indirect route through the TJAG to get to the CCA. And you don't have to make an improper negative implication. I concur that Landgraf talked about that implication, but just note that the Supreme Court later used that canon of statutory construction in the Lind case, L-I-N-D-H, and so I don't know that it's off limits completely. But when you look at the plain language and you have to look at the statutory scheme as a whole, all of the relevant articles of the UCMJ, 57, 65, 66, 69, and 76, when you look at them as a whole, it makes sense that the CCAs, as they all four have found, had jurisdiction, and we would ask the court to hold that the court had jurisdiction.
Thank you, Ms. Zimmerman.
Thank you.
Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
All rise. Court stands adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.